one of the great joys of my job is getting to see things that we pray for as a church, and get to see how God moves and responds to the things that we're praying for. And many of you will recall about 2.5 months ago, we had been waiting as a church in great joy for the birth of Daniel and Rachel Butts' little baby. She'd been, you know, pregnant, and we were waiting and praying. And so the day came, July 15th, and I had been talking to Daniel on the via text, and he said, "Hey, we took Rachel to the hospital. Baby's coming. We were so excited." And I'm sitting at home, and I get a text, and it was simply said this. This is all it said. It said, "He's here. Not good. Pray." That's all I got. And if you want to see my heart stop like that, send me a text like that. And so that day, we had a visit that we had to make for another family in the church to go pray for someone. It was Dan and Sarah Gobin. Dan's daughter, Tara, was very ill, and we went and prayed for her. And that day, Tara went home to be with Jesus. So that was obviously very sad. But as we're walking out of the hospital, I get a text from Daniel. And I'm not going to tell you what that text said. He's going to explain it for you here in just a minute. He shared with me kind of the more depth of the situation. Well, fortunately, we were right at UMC, so we just crossed the parking lot over to the East Tower where the medical facilities were. I met Mike outside. Mike is Daniel's dad, and he got us back there, and the situation was not good. And we immediately began praying, and we got all of you praying too. Well, how many of you really get encouraged when you hear what your prayers did? Anybody? One or two of you? All right. Well, Daniel and Rachel, I'm going to ask them to come. Would you guys welcome them as they come? And they are going to, we've been waiting for this Sunday, and we've talked about it ever since that day on July 15th. You know, Daniel and Rachel, we just absolutely love them. Rachel, as many of you know, is a dancer, and I say this every time they come up here for something, but she's done some really worshipful dances for us here, and Daniel is just you know, you can't know Daniel and not like him. If you did, I wouldn't trust you. So anyway, I was gonna say I can't ever. This is Daniel and Rachel Butts, so I almost said we got to get our butts up here, and so. Anyway, I'm sure they love those kind of jokes. I know they do. Anyway, we've invited them to give you kind of the behind the scenes. Most of you know most of the story, but we wanted to give you the behind the scenes look. And so give them your attention. They're going to have some pictures up on the screen and let you kind of follow along with the story of this miracle as they go. Here you go, guys.
I was going to pretend I was talking to you and just ignore all these people. This is going to be rough, so y'all bear with me. I can't look at those pictures still.
Great idea.
All right. Like Mark said, he was born on July 15th, which is also my birthday. So right after he was born, Rachel looked at me and she said, "Don't ever expect me to top that birthday present." So that was pretty funny, but... he was born and he had his cord wrapped around his neck. And so at first I thought, "Oh, that's not a big deal. We can get past that." And they put him on Rachel's chest, and they were trying to get him to breathe and to cry, and they couldn't get him to do it after a couple minutes. And so they took him over. They have one of those little NICU beds over there. And they put him in that, and they just kept calling more and more people in. And there were, I don't know, probably 18 people come running in the room, and they're all yelling and doing different things, and it seemed like everyone was doing different things to work on him. And they still didn't know what was wrong. The doctor, they listened to his heart, and they said it was on the wrong side of his chest. So his heart was over here, and so he stuck a breathing tube down him because he wasn't breathing at all, at zero breathing on his own. And they put him in one of those little boxes, incubators, what they're called, I think. It's the same thing they call for birds, and it's kind of weird, but they put him in that little glass box, and they rolled him over to him, and they said, "Here's your son, we're taking him." And so we got to look at him for a second, and they took him off. And they were still, you know, they were checking on Rachel, making sure she was okay. So I got to go go back, and that's what I saw when I got back. They had all that stuff done to him, and they have him medically paralyzed, and you know, covering up his ears and his eyes because they didn't want to stimulate him at all. And then after, I don't know, it felt like a couple hours. It probably wasn't that long. One of the surgeons came back, and they told us that he has a congenital diaphragmatic hernia, which I've never heard of that. I don't know what that is. But they explained that there was a hole in his hernia. So his stomach is in, and his diaphragm, excuse me. There was a hole in his diaphragm, so his stomach and his intestines all ended up in his chest. And they don't know. They don't know when it happened. We know that it was kind of early on, because what that did was it crushed both his lungs and his heart to where both his lungs were completely collapsed, and his heart was just under an immense amount of pressure. And his left lung didn't even develop correctly. He still, like right now, only has half a lung on his left side, but that grows back over time. I didn't know that. A kid can grow a lung till they're 5 years old, which is pretty awesome. Anyway, they told us that he needed this surgery, and the people in Lubbock were not positive at all. Our outlook was not good. They said we're gonna try to fly him to Dallas, and you know, if he makes it there, if he makes it to Dallas, they have some equipment that they can put him on that we don't have here. And so I was like, all right. I said, well, what are you waiting on? Let's get that going. And so that's a pretty long process. They got to call Dallas and they sent their helicopter, which is like an emergency room inside a helicopter. It's a pretty really big thing. And at first they told me, they said, you'll get to ride with them, Dad and Mom, because Mom's still going to be here at the hospital. And I was like, okay, great. And they came back like 2 hours later and they told me that he was so critical they had to have other doctors on board. So I didn't get to fly with them after all. I'm getting ahead of myself. When they came back to the room, that surgeon kept saying, the Lubbock surgeon kept saying, if he survives, and that was the prognosis for probably about 8 days. The first 8 days, that's all we heard was, if he survives, we'll do this. If he survives, we'll do this. And so I pulled the nurse aside because I still didn't understand what they were talking about. I was confused and in shock and everything else. And I said, how bad is this? I'm confused. And she just looked at me. She said, that's the most critical baby I've ever seen. So that's the thing that stuck in my mind that she told me. And anyway, the helicopter landed. They were supposed to leave at 8 o'clock, but it took them 4 hours to get them stable enough to take off. So they didn't end up taking off till about midnight. They were working on them the whole time, and you know, they had them on the breathing machine, and they kept having to bag them because the breathing machine wasn't doing what it was supposed to. But my dad called his boss, and he explained what was going on, and he got us his private plane and flew us to Dallas on his private plane. And Rachel got dismissed like 7 hours after she gave birth. She was walking on a runway with us. So.
She'll be bragging about that to you ladies for forever.
Yeah. Without pain medicine or anything, she did it all natural, which if men have babies, there'd be a whole lot less babies in the world. That's all I'm saying. But anyway, so we ended up beating Sam there by, I don't know, several hours. We beat him there, and we got set up and got in a hotel and everything. And we got there in the next morning. This was Sunday morning, and we already had family members there. Not like blood family members, but Hayden's grandparents were there. They were already in Dallas, so they met us there at the hospital. So we had a friendly face as soon as we got there. And then the Sharps actually got there that night too, and they stayed with us for the first week, which was really awesome because we weren't there by ourselves. And so they came and they told us that he had to be put on ECMO, which I don't know what that stands for. I'm not going to try to make something up, but it's full life support. So if you'll find that picture, I don't know if they're in order. I should have checked to make sure they were in order. But basically ECMO is that's another one before all the stuff they had hooked up to him. He's all wires. There it is right there. ECMO is full life support. So they actually went in and they cut into his jugular vein and they took all his blood out and they pumped it through this machine and they put oxygen in it. Since his lungs weren't doing that, they were able to put oxygen in it. They took all the toxins and stuff out. Basically, like, his body wasn't doing anything. That machine did everything for him. And the survival rate of ECMO is about 50%. And they gave us about a 30% chance with him, with being on ECMO on top of his lungs and his heart and everything. And so that was pretty scary. But he was on ECMO for about 6 days, and at first they told us that we're going to try to go in and repair him once he's stabilized enough. So they said we're looking at doing that maybe in 2 weeks at the earliest. We're like, okay, so right now we're just going to wait and let the machine do its job and see what they're doing. On day two, there was a really big clot right outside that hose going right back into his neck, and it was a big one on day two. So it was there for 5 days, and that's the biggest concern when it comes to ECMO, is he's on major amounts of blood thinner to prevent the machine from clotting up, but they still haven't found a way to trick blood into not thinking that it's in a body when it's in plastic, so it coagulates automatically. And so with the massive amounts of blood thinner, he was at real high risk for brain bleeds. And then, of course, if the clotting was the main thing, you know, and with that clot, it was about 3 inches from 3 inches from his neck, from going into him, not coming out. It was right there, and it was there for 5 days. That's why I kept on the updates. I kept saying, just pray that clot doesn't move and that no more for him. And it stayed there the entire time. That never moved, man. But I asked the ECMO. I think we had like 16 specialists. I can't even. But there was one. That's all he did. He sat there and watched the machine for 12 hours. And I asked him, I said, what happens if that clot goes in there? And he said, he'll die. And I was like, all right, well, that's something else to pray for. And then they came up to us, I don't know, 4 days later, and they said, we're going to try to do his, day three, we're going to do his surgery on ECMO, which everything we had heard is that is not good. That means, like, this is like a last Hail Mary. We're going to see if we can get his body to do something before his organs start shutting down and stuff like that. So obviously we were very nervous about that, and the actual repair is not that big of a deal. I mean, they can go in and they push everything down, and they were able to do a primary repair on him, which means they just sewed it closed. They didn't have to go in and add a patch or add any artificial stuff in there, which is really good, because that causes a lot of trouble later on in life as he grows. And so basically they brought us in and said, here, you can see your son before we do this. And the repair went fine. Nothing happened afterwards. And they said the next 48 hours is going to tell us everything, whether he wants to fight or whether, you know, he's gonna die. And he did perfect. And everything they wanted, like, we want this to happen in a few hours, and he would do it in like 10 minutes. And every single goal they set, he was just like blowing out of the water. And even the doctor was like, the doctor came in and she said, I can't even tell you that this is rare, because this has never happened. I've never seen this. And this is at a hospital. We were at Dallas Children's Medical Center, and this is what they specialize in. So, and she said, they've only seen two of them in the last 2 years, and the other one was there at the same time as we were, and he didn't make it. I think most of y'all probably heard about that in some of my updates, but he died. And but anyway, so after that, after he came off, they said, we'll watch him really closely for the first 48 hours. We really don't want him to get any infections. And, you know, make sure that his lungs are working on his own. So his right lung inflated and worked perfectly immediately once they relieved the pressure off. And his left lung, it popped open, and the half of, that he had there, and it started working instantly. And she says she's never seen that happen either before. So
it's just soon.
That was really cool. And she said, she just came to us, she said, I can't take credit for any of that. And we're like, yeah, we know. I mean, we're not trying to be rude, but we know. And so anyway, they said, the biggest thing we have to watch for now is infections. And the first 2 days were good. He cleared the first 48-hour mark. And I'm good. He cleared the first 48-hour mark. And me and Rachel pretty much just stood in that room for 12 or 14 hours a day. We didn't even have a couch because all the equipment, there was no room for us. So we just kind of stood up and stayed in there and prayed all day. But I checked his temperature one day, and his fever was really high. So I went and got the nurse, and I said, hey, he's got a really high fever. And he was on morphine a lot. And they were trying to back off his morphine, and they put him on methadone, which is a withdrawal medicine. It's a what they give people who are addicted to, you know, meth, morphine, all that stuff to help with their withdrawals. And he said, it could be that. I said, or it could be infection. And I was like, well, let's do whatever we can and make sure it's not an infection. Well, then they came back It'd been, I don't remember how long. It took him a while because they took some blood cultures from him. And then they came back and they said, he does have an infection, and it's called Bacillus cereus. And I was like, well, that's not good. If that's serious in the name, that can't be good. And then the doctor said, we have never seen this in a kid before. And I was like, oh, awesome. So good. I'm so excited about all this news. And they said, in fact, they called up a team of infectious disease doctors. And like five of them came up. And I was all expecting them to be in hazmat suits and all this stuff. But they were just in their regular doctor coats. And they said, we've never seen this in a kid. We have no idea how he got it. And it comes from feces. So somehow feces got in one of his IV lines. I mean, he had like 18 lines going into him. But no one could figure out, you know, what that caused. And it wasn't good. Like that can cause a lot of, you know, long-term damage as far as, you know, brain damage and him being blind and not being able to hear and stuff like that. But they went ahead and they started the antibiotics immediately. And within 24 hours, it was coming back negative. So it kicked that really fast. Just another, I don't know, another dip in the roller coaster, I guess it was, is what you call it. And then, let's see, what happened next? I wrote all this down last night, so I won't forget, and I didn't bring my notes, so that did a lot of good. So after that, they told us, well, first of all, I forgot, I was back from the beginning, when we first got to the hospital, I was trying to, you know, work things out with work and getting someone to take care of the house and all that stuff that doesn't really matter. And I said, how long do we need to plan on being here? And at first they told us, you should plan on being here for a minimum of 2 months. We're like, 2 months? Whoa, that's a long time. And then they also told me that after this, the only other baby to survive the surgery on ECMO, he's only the second in that hospital to ever survive it. That baby turned one in ICU, and so they spent about the first 18 months of that kid's life in the hospital. And man, we were there for 5 weeks, which seems like forever, but compared to that, man, it could have been way worse. But so the next step after that, like, we're gonna see, you know, keep seeing if he's breathing on his own. They brought him out of his medically induced coma, and we got to see him start to open his eyes. And he couldn't cry or anything because he still had all the stuff in his throat and feeding tubes and all that stuff. And yeah, you can keep going, Zach. I'm sorry. Yeah, there's all the stuff he had hooked up to. You can see him on that little bed there in the middle. So they have nitric oxide. And I did include some, it's hard to tell on there, but the squiggly lines up there on the top right of his chest are his intestines. And if you'll follow one of those, you can follow those tubes, how it's over there to the right of his stomach, that's where the very end of his stomach was way higher than it was supposed to be. So that in the background is the actual ECMO machine. He was on 12 different medication pumps. He was on the breathing machine. He was on nitric oxide, not nitrous. I thought it was nitrous. He's going to be really fast when we get home. everything you can imagine they had hooked up to him. That's the first time he opened his eyes right there, kind of. I mean, he barely opened his eyes. And he'd open his eyes, and he looked at me and looked at Rachel, and then he'd close them and go back to sleep for a little bit. The first time we got to hold him, he was about 3 weeks old. And it was a major ordeal because we had to have several doctors come in and move everything, you know, make sure that breathing tube in his, because the breathing tube can actually puncture his lung pretty easily. So it was quite an ordeal. They ended up having six people help us pick him up, moving all the wires and sit him down just so we could hold him for a few minutes. And keep going. That's when he actually opened his eyes, when some of the drugs were out of his system. You know, looks more like a normal baby there, even though he's got all that stuff hooked up to him. And that's the first time. Rachel got to hold him first, so I didn't hold him first before y'all throw stuff at me. But, So he's about 3 weeks old when she finally got to hold him. There you can see his incision there on his right side, and then a little bit higher up he's got a chest tube that they put in because they're just draining fluid off of his lungs. And then of course the surgery on his neck, he's got like a 4-inch incision on his neck where they cut into his artery. That was one of the pictures we sent up in our update when he was awake. And at this point, that was the first time they told us that they were cautiously optimistic, was the word they used. you know, that he would pull through and be fine. And then even then, the surgeon told us that babies in his situation, even ECMO babies, 70 to 90% of them end up with brain damage and like cognitive development issues. And they were giving us the whole spiel on what all that could be. But he's just a normal baby. He doesn't have any brain damage at all. They did a scan and there was nothing on there. And, it's hard to tell on a baby, but one of the ways I said they can tell is if they make eye contact with you and they can track, like when if you move, they follow you, or if they try to follow you to find your voice. And he's been doing all that from the time he woke up from his little medically induced coma. So we're very hopeful there. We don't have any fears at all there. And let's see. So after that, after all his surgeries and he was breathing on his own, they kept turning down the oxygen and turning it down. And then they'd lower him to a different machine and turn that one down. And finally they had him just on room oxygen, just a little nose cannula. And they said, well, next we got to see if he can eat. Because babies like this, they forget how to suck. And so it's hard to teach them how to eat. And it takes months and months to teach them how to eat and all that stuff. So that was our next big obstacle. But Rachel worked with him all day, every day. I don't know what day it was when he finally latched on. But how long were you trying, though? After a week, he started eating on his own. So then, yeah, that was huge. That was the biggest thing that was going to keep us there for a long period of time. And Rachel, I'm real proud of her. She was just real diligent and stayed there all day and all night, working with him every feeding. And he just did it one day. I was holding him and I said, listen here, buddy. I said, you're a boy. You're supposed to like boobs. Excuse me. I know. All right. There you go. Thank you, Paul. I said, I need you to do this so we. I need you to do this so we can go home. And of course we prayed and Rachel sent out an update and said, please pray for us so that he'll latch on. And he latched on that very next feeding, 3 hours after that update. And so it was just, man, he answered every single one of our prayers. And sometimes I still forget that that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to pray and just wait instead of calling everyone and letting everyone know, just pray. And it is important to let people know so that, you know, we had the whole church and I don't know, half the world praying for us, it seemed like. That was really the last thing that kept us there, and he did that, and we were there for another week. They moved us down out of ICU into a room with a kind of had a bed, and we were allowed to eat in there. You can keep going, Zach. So just a little bit less stuff. That's just the breathing cannula in his nose there. Oh yeah, my police department did a fundraiser for me, a big one. It turned out way bigger than anyone was anticipating. And they had about 3,000 people show up to a brisket dinner they had. And Lubbock PD showed up, and Cooper PD, and Friendship PD. And just, you know, all the police officers, they're really good about taking care of each other. But it was very humbling to do. On top of a fundraiser that Lubbock ISD did for me, separately from the police department. And then also, most of you saw the GoFundMe that my sister set up for us. So we were definitely taken care of financially, and that was a huge blessing for us not to have to worry about he's about a $2.5 million baby at this point. So there you go. Yeah. So they're just down to the feeding, and they kept that feeding. I think he was actually eating at this point, but they kept that feeding tube in his nose for another week just in case. And that's his 1 month. He's 1 month old right there. So yeah. Caught him grinning. He's a happy baby. He smiles a whole lot. So you can keep going, Zach. There's our bed. So just awesome. Very comfortable. It's a pillow top. If it's too short for Rachel, I don't know who designs those places. But anyway, another time I got him smiling, real happy. They took his feeding tube out there. Yeah, he looks like a normal baby. This part of the fundraiser, you can see, that's Lubbock High. They have a really big cafeteria, and they smoked about 45 briskets and completely sold out of all of them. It was really cool to see that. That's Dr. Deason. She's our surgeon. She's a really cool Christian lady. She doesn't, you know, hide the fact that she does the best she can and the rest is up to God. She was very open about that. And she came in and the last 2 days we were there, she just came in and held them for 2 hours and just talking with us and telling all the other nurses about how, you know, incredible and fast his recovery was and everything like that. And she's really cool. I mean, she's just sweetest lady ever. And yeah, she told us a little bit about the two extremes and what everyone was expecting to happen and then what actually did happen. So she was able to give us a little more inside information on that, which I've already shared with you guys. That's still the fundraiser that they did for me for Sam at the Lubbock High. Keep going. Oh, yeah. This is the family we stayed with. This is Rachel's uncle's sister, is that lady there in the front. And they are both, I've never met them. And Rachel met them when she was real little. Like, she barely remembers them. But they found out we were there, and they came up and visited us at the hospital. He called me on my cell phone and said, hey, we have an extra bedroom. We want you to stay with us so y'all can stop paying for hotels. And at first I was like, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to stay in someone else's house. But after we talked with them, and Rachel's like, I really want to do that. And I was like, all right, let's do it. So they're both clinical psychologists. And, And yeah, he actually gave up his clinical psychology practice, and he's a gourmet chef. And so we ate good. But
is there any better therapy in the world?
He's making stuff I can't even say or ever heard of. But they had a special needs kid. He was born. They told him that he wouldn't live past the hour, and that kid lived till he was 21 years old. And just a huge, I mean, there's textbooks written on that kid, just because it's a miracle that he ever survived anything. So they understood what we were going through, and it was just really cool to have a friendly face, you know, and to come home, and he would cook lunch for us and bring it up to the hospital some days, and they really spoiled us. They took really good care of us. They're family now. That's that's about all there is to that. But that's the last picture, the latest picture I took at him. He looks like a normal baby. You can't tell. He looks like Rachel's brother. Exactly. And I think that's the first time Jamie got to meet him. She didn't get to go to the hospital. She wasn't allowed on the floor. And so we waited till we got home and brought her up. So she got to meet Sam. And she just loves him, as you can imagine. She's always kissing him on the head. And when he cries or gets fussy, she runs up. She goes, Sam's sad. So we got to run over. She takes really good care of him already. She's a great little sister, big sister. I forget. Is that the last one? Thought so. Okay. So now.
Well, what we're going to do now, are you guys, go ahead, yes, go ahead, by all means.
Yeah. Okay, so I have just a few, like, emotional things to share. I'm going to try not to cry really hard. So on the ECMO machine, that was the one thing that felt like really, really scary to us. We really didn't want him to have to be put on that. I mean, nobody does, but I don't know, for some reason I had a really bad gut feeling about it, and then when they told us that he had to be put on it, Daniel and I were just, you know, broke down, and I was just like, God, why is this happening? Like, what? Why? And he gave me, I got the benefit in some ways of waking up every couple hours to pump so that Sam would have something to eat, and so it gave me a chance to pray for him every couple of hours, like, in through the night, and he gave me a picture of his hands in front of Sam, and the blood was going through them. So I believe that the clot stayed there because God's hands were right there. I thought that was awesome. Like, his hands have holes. They were going straight through, but nothing got to Sam's body without passing through his hands. Like, what a beautiful picture. I needed that as a mommy. And then I just want to thank the body of Christ here for the way you rallied for us. That was huge to know that we were held and we were not alone. I mean, to have our parents with us, to have my father-in-law with us, to have Mark and Ginger come, it meant the world to us. So thank you, thank you, thank you for your prayers, for the financial gifts, for all the ways that you held us up. It's more than we can say thank you for. But we're so grateful. And I remember taking him home. There's many things I could share, and I won't spend too much time. But on the way home, I was just kind of terrified because, you know, he had a hard time breathing. So that was It's like, I'm gonna wake up every couple moments in the night, hoping he's still alive and breathing. And on the way home, we got home, and we're driving home, sorry, and God told me, he's my boy. It's not up to you. He's my boy. Mm. I was like,
awesome.
All right.